Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Crime Ghoul, and welcome to Ghoultober. So what is Ghoultober, some of you may ask? Well, it's a spooky month for my podcast in which I will be presenting cases that have super, super creepy elements to them. And although this is a themed month, it is really important for you guys to remember that these are real-life people, and these are real-life crime cases. This is serious content and it is intense content. It may be obvious, but please understand that heavy trigger warnings are advised. The point of my podcast is to bring awareness to lesser known cases or to examine high profile cases. Most of the time, there is something to be learned and something to take away from these horrifying cases. And sometimes there's even ways to help the families and survivors, and my main point is always victim advocacy. I feel like this can't be stressed enough, and sometimes people view true crime as entertainment, but it's super important to remember why this type of content is created and discussed in the first place. So thank you so much for being here, and thank you for giving these cases attention. So we're going to jump right into it. We're going to get right down to it. You know the cue. It's a little different this time, but go brew yourself a cup of coffee, preferably pumpkin spice, or pour yourself a pumpkin beer, or perhaps take a shot of whiskey, because as always, these true crime cases are not for the faint of heart. Thank you so much for listening. So if you couldn't guess by that lovely intro and the name of today's episode, today's case is about someone who is a Jason Voorhees wannabe. He is going to wreak havoc on a city in Massachusetts. But first and foremost, I want you to remember one important name from this case, and that's Shannon Gregory. And we'll get to her soon. But first and foremost, I always want to make sure we're remembering the correct person. We're remembering the right name. All too often, we remember the killer's name, and in this case, I want to make sure that this does not happen. Our story brings us to Greenfield, Massachusetts, and the year is 1988. It's October 24th, and it's just a week before Halloween. The town is festive, and Greenfield is a picturesque and vibrant city. They have a bustling main street, and this location is known for their art and culture. The city is also made up of quiet residential neighborhoods. Fall was in full swing in Greenfield. You know, the smell of outdoor fires burning, autumn leaves covered the sidewalk, and there was a chill in the air. October is always a show-off, especially in the New England area. Kids were getting their Halloween costumes ready, and the townspeople were preparing for their annual Halloween parade. All was well in Greenfield, Massachusetts. No one could have expected the fear that was about to descend upon this town. On the outside looking in, Greenfield was quaint, quiet, and happy, like these towns always are. But on the inside, there was a disturbed individual named Mark Branch, and he was about to turn the town on its head. You see, Mark was 18 years old, and he had a long list of problems. He struggled with mental health for much of his life, and I mean, there's a lot of us that do. I think we all have our problems, but something was different about Mark Branch and the way he handled his demons. Mark was fascinated by all things horror, and again, like many of us, we love horror. But I think Mark took horror to the next level. He wasn't just obsessed with horror. No, he wanted to become horror. He wanted to be the monster, the killer, the slasher. And in 1988, he decided that Greenfield was his horror movie, and he was ready to be the main character. He was ready to make the town scream. Mark was a grocery store worker. He worked at the local Stop and Shop, and in his free time, he watched nothing but slasher films. He also helped the local video store, Video Expo 1, on weekends. The owner, Robert Quenzel, would say that Mark strictly rented horror movies and horror movies only, and the gorier, the better. Mark specifically idolized Jason Voorhees from the Friday the 13th series. You know, that's the killer who sports a hockey mask and a machete, but first wears a, like, potato sack over his head, and who has the big-time mommy issues. Yeah, that one. Mark's favorite film from the series was Friday the 13th, The Final Chapter, which hit theaters back in 1984, which was just 4 years prior to this story. And I want you guys to know that the details of this case are scarce, and we only know bits and fragments of what truly happened. So I'm going to give you a rundown of what I scrounged up while doing my research. Early in the morning, Mark left his house. His friend Scott Landry picked him up. Scott brought Mark to an appointment at the Massachusetts Rehab Center, and after the appointment, they planned to hang out. They were going to head over to Scott's house and watch and record shows on MTV, which just cracks me up that back then they would record the shows on MTV. I mean, I guess people do that if you still have DVR, but still, the times are just so different. Soon after they returned to the Landry house, Scott got a phone call from his friend Sharon Gregory. Sharon was an acquaintance of Mark, and Mark was also an acquaintance with her twin sister Cheryl. The twins had mutual friends with both Scott and Mark. So that morning, Sharon called Scott to ask for help. She was crying on the phone, and she wanted to know if Scott had a car she could use because hers wouldn't start. Scott was concerned and asked Sharon if she was okay. She said that she wasn't sure, and she went on to explain that she was upset over not being able to contact her boyfriend, Chris, that morning. And she also explained that after being upset about that, she tried to get in her car, but the car wouldn't start. It's not really clear what happened after this phone call besides Scott sharing this information with Mark. I don't know why Scott didn't go over there to help. I don't know if it was just because he was with Mark and he was like, oh, I'm sorry, like, I'm hanging with my friend, I can't come over, I can't help you, or I don't have a car, you know, to loan you. And maybe she was like, okay, I'm going to call someone else. Not really sure. There's not many details here. But basically, Scott relayed the information to Mark after hanging up the phone, and Mark asked why her parents or sister couldn't just drive her. And Scott told him that her parents were at work and Cheryl was at school, so no one was at the house to help. After having that conversation, Mark went to make a phone call in the other room. And to this day, we don't know who he made the phone call to. But Mark then asked Scott to take him home because he wanted to go get his car and pick up his paycheck from the local Stop and Shop where he worked. Needless to say, Mark would never go to pick up his paycheck. But he did stop home and he did get his car. Before leaving the house, his mom saw him around 10:30 that morning and said that she headed out to go shopping, and that was the last she would see of her son. And like I said, we don't know who Mark called while at Scott's house, but one could wonder if Mark maybe called Sharon stating that he was going to come over and help her out. Because the next place that Mark goes is to Sharon Gregory's house. It's important to mention that Mark Branch was not happy with Sharon. Details are scarce here, but allegedly Sharon had written a paper that was inspired by Mark. Sharon was a freshman student at Greenfield Community College, and she was taking a Psychology 101 class. And allegedly, there was an assignment in which students had to write a psychological profile on someone that they knew. I don't know how I feel about this assignment. I mean, it was the 80s, so I guess maybe they didn't mind doing invasive assignments. I don't know. And we don't exactly know these assignment details, and I'll get to that later, but I know that when I was in Psych 101, we were provided with something that was called a vignette, which is a description of a fake person, and we did have to write a paper explaining what we thought the person was struggling with. So I'm not sure what the details were about Sharon Gregory's assignment, but I do know that Sharon was fascinated with Mark's fascination with horror and obsession with horror films. So Sharon would later tell Mark that she wrote a profile about him, and he was pretty annoyed and uncomfortable. No one in the town knew it, but Mark was ready to create his own version of the final chapter. He knew where the Gregory house was located, and now he knew that Sharon was all alone. So Mark headed to the residence, and he was dressed in a jean jacket, blue jeans, and he had big black combat boots, which, mind you, he boasted about because they were like the same combat boots that Jason had in the Friday the 13th movies. And he also brought Jason's mask with him. He collected a variation of Jason Voorhees' masks. He picked one and he headed out. So Mark would pull up to the Gregory residence, where he eerily entered the house. And all of the details as to what transpired in Sharon's home that day are not completely known. But evidence would show that it is likely that Mark entered the home, and Sharon likely saw this horrifying person dressed up like Jason Voorhees. She quickly sprinted up the stairs, and the figure clad in the hockey goalie mask chased Sharon up those stairs while violently stabbing at her. He would chase her all the way up through the second floor hallway into the bathroom where Sharon tried to hide, and she was ultimately brutally stabbed to death. Mark viciously stabbed her, and he stabbed her over 24 times. There were wounds to her back, her head, and her throat had been slashed. Later, a detective would describe the scene as Sharon being sliced into ribbons. Obviously, this was like something straight out of a horror film, but this was real, and I can't imagine how frightened Sharon must have been. I'm sure she knew it was Mark. She had to have, especially with all the horror movie obsession, and who else is obsessed with Jason Voorhees like that in town? It's just absolutely terrifying. And one of my worst fears, I don't know about you guys, but like, I have this weird, like, irrational fear of like walking into my bedroom at night when it's dark and bumping into Michael Myers. And I know that's just like awful, but like, maybe it's not such an irrational fear because obviously there are people out there that exist like Mark Branch. So needless to say, Mark left Sharon, he left the house, and his crime took him no longer than 10 minutes. It was reported that it actually took less than 10 minutes, which, again, absolutely horrifying. Later, a witness would come forward to kind of corroborate this timeline, but I'll get to that later. About 2 hours would go by before Sharon's mutilated body was found. And unfortunately, her identical twin sister, Cheryl, was the one who discovered her body. It had to be a terrifying scene. Cheryl came home after a long day at school, and she immediately noticed blood on the stairs and blood in the upstairs hallway that was leading to the upstairs bathroom. She would walk into the bathroom and find her twin laying dead in the bathtub. It was a disturbing scene, a mutilation stabbing death. Sharon was fully clothed, but her clothing was stained red, and it was clear that she had multiple gashes across her body. Cheryl came home to a movie straight out of a slasher film, except way worse. There was no fake blood, no actor, no director. This was her sister, and it was real life. She had to be absolutely devastated to find her identical twin sister left in such a horrible manner. She quickly called the police, and law enforcement arrived on the scene within minutes. And they wondered, who could have done this? Who could have killed this sweet and kind college student? A detective spoke to Cheryl, and when he asked if she knew anyone who could have done this, one name left her lips, Mark. Cheryl went on to explain some details to the officer. She didn't know Mark's last name, but she did know that he hung around a guy named Scott Landry, who lived nearby. Sharon had actually told her sister that Mark frightened her. Mark would coldly stare at Sharon, and it would disturb her greatly. And I just get like a shiver kind of down my spine, guys, like when I say that. Because if you've ever looked into the eyes of someone that you were like, oh, they're probably evil, or like there's low key something not right there, you know why. Because it's just like this, like, I don't even know, this daunting feeling. Like, it's just not good. It's like a foreboding feeling when a person like that looks at you. So police went on to question some of Sharon's friends, and they all brought up the same concern about Mark Branch. Police went to question Mark at his house, but he wasn't home. But his mother, Betty Branch, was. This was not the first time that police had been to the Branch residence. I couldn't find details to explain why police had been there in the past, but I have a feeling things were not good at that home. And Mark also caused a lot of trouble at school, and, you know, I'll get into that later. But Betty would say that she last saw her son that morning before she went out shopping, and when she returned, he wasn't at the house. Investigators entered the Branch residence and took a look around Mark's room. They noticed that his bedroom looked like a little horror museum. There were hundreds of horror magazines, various types of machetes, and various types of knives. His room was made up of all things horror, like literally everything except for his clothing. It was clear that Mark was infatuated with Jason Voorhees, and friends who knew Branch would tell police that he fantasized about what it would be like to kill a person. Police searched for Mark around town, but there was no sign of him. They would continue to gather information and find that there was a similar theme. They spoke to people who knew Sharon and Mark, and it appeared that Sharon had written a psychological profile on Mark Branch. Some media news outlets stated that Sharon was in a Psych 101 class and wrote a paper on Mark's well-known horror film obsession, and then created a profile for him based off of this information. So you see, like, the details are kind of similar, but also kind of different, because others would say that Mark had given Sharon's sister, Cheryl, that's right, her identical twin, an actual hard copy of a psych evaluation of himself because he struggled with his own mental health, and Cheryl was allegedly interested in learning more about Mark. Then Sharon allegedly wrote her own psych profile on Mark Branch based off of the psych evaluation that was given to Cheryl. So you see, there's a lot of details. There's a lot of, like, the same but different information. It's really hard to put the pieces together here. And my thing is, if Cheryl did have that psych evaluation, like the hard copy, then how would she not know Mark's last name? You know, because it would say on the paper. And then there was another report that apparently Cheryl kept the psych evaluation and cut Mark's name off of the paper and then let her sister see it so she could use it to write, like, her, you know, her Psych 101 paper. So really, who knows for sure? You know, some people said the paper was for school. Some speculated that it was a private profile she did on, you know, Mark Branch with his consent. But, you know, like, that, I don't know, that doesn't sound really plausible. And there are some reports that say that Sharon Gregory was a psych major, but then there's also, like, reports that she loved art and theater and was really heavily influenced by, like, the arts. So I'm not sure. Again, it's really hard to find concrete information about this case. But regardless, the alleged paper that she wrote was never found. But police determined that Mark had become furious with Sharon and ultimately killed her in a brutal and terrifying way because of this paper, you know, this write-up she had. So here's some additional information that police learned through various sources. We'll start with the witness that came forward. There was a man named Michael Rockwell, and he was a neighbor to the west of the Gregory household. He came into the Greenfield Police Department that night that Sharon was murdered, and he wanted to give a statement that would shed more light on what happened earlier that day to Sharon Gregory. So Michael had just begun to watch TV when he heard the sound of a car door closing, and the sound came from the driveway to the east of the house. He looked out his window and observed a dark gray Chevette, possibly two doors, parked facing into the driveway. The front end of the Chevette was about even with the walk going from the driveway to the front door of the residence. Michael observed a white male approximately 6 feet tall, approximately 180 to 195 pounds, with dark hair. Michael said that his hair was a long military cut, and he didn't notice any facial hair on the man. The man was wearing jean-type pants, a jean-type jacket, both of stone-washed or acid-dyed color. The man looked clean cut, and he had his hands in his pockets. Michael then watched him walk to the front door, and he said that the man was not wearing glasses. Between about 3 and 5 minutes later, Michael again heard a car door from the direction of the driveway. He looked out the window again and saw the same person seated in the Chevette. He heard the engine start and saw the Chevette back out of the driveway and head west. Approximately 30 to 40 minutes later, Michael again heard a car in the same driveway, but this time looking out, he saw Cheryl's car pull in, and moments later, he saw police cars arrive. So first of all, it's awesome that Mr. Michael Rockwell was so, like, alert, and he heard car doors and, like, looked out the window. I'm, like, one of those nosy neighbors, I'm not gonna lie. Like, if I hear something outside, I'm like, what's going on out there? Like, what? Who is that? So good thing he did, so he could, you know, kind of vouch for the timeline, although obviously there are some variations in the timestamps. Like, you know, I don't know if Mark really went in there and killed Sharon within 3 to 5 minutes. Like, that's just so terrifying, and that makes me think about so many other various crimes, especially like the Idaho 4. Anyway, I'm not gonna get off into a tangent about that, but it's scary if it could be done that quickly. Also, I wonder, like, you know, he saw him go in and he didn't have, like, a Jason Voorhees mask on. So I wonder where that came into play. I mean, I guess I kind of see where it did. And, you know, again, I'll go into that in a little while. But also, he said that he saw Cheryl's car about 30 to 40 minutes later, whereas, you know, Cheryl, well, there was another report that said Cheryl came home within, like, 2 hours after the murder. So, yeah, there's some variations here. But needless to say, like, it kind of makes sense. Like, somebody pulled up, Sharon was killed, then the sister came home. Anyway, Michael Rockwell was provided a photograph of Mark Branch, and he identified him as the person he saw coming and going from the Gregory residence. In the meantime, police were still trying to gather details and information. They talked to Scott Landry, and Scott had told them that he had known Mark since third or fourth grade, that they have been really good friends. But he said Mark had issues in school and that he had gone to a school for troubled kids. He also told police that Mark's mother had told him that Mark had tried to commit suicide on at least one occasion. Scott said that Mark had been hospitalized at Belmont State Hospital for nearly a year between the ages of 16 and 18, and that he attended the Northampton Center for Children and Family Services, which had full-time residential facilities, and Mark had graduated from one of these facilities. Police then interviewed Scott Landry's girlfriend, Amy, and she provided some similar disturbing details. She said that Mark was very interested in the Friday the 13th movies and the killer in the movie, Jason Voorhees. She said that Mark fantasized about being Jason and what it would be like to kill someone. She also told police that Mark collected movie memorabilia from this and other horror films, and then he bragged about having Jason dolls, hockey masks from the film, and videotapes of the movies. He also boasted about having similar combat boots worn by Jason in the movies. So, of course, like I said before, a search of Mark's room confirmed this, and police found more than what was originally expected. So yeah, this guy was heavily obsessed with horror movies, which, you know, of course, like, a lot of us like horror, like, it's my favorite genre, but you don't see me wanting to be Michael Myers or Freddy Krueger, you know what I'm saying? So obviously, this man, Mark Branch, was a very disturbed individual. And, you know, you're hearing some of these reports, it's like, if my friend told me they were fantasizing about killing someone, like, I would be concerned. I don't know if they were, but clearly they didn't like take it seriously. Or I don't know, maybe Scott thought, okay, he's going, you know, my friend's going to a rehab facility. He's gotten help in the past. Like, hopefully he'll be fine. Like, I'm not sure. But I just feel like sometimes we don't take people seriously when they say some messed up stuff. And, you know, maybe we should. So Cheryl Gregory would provide more details and stated that in August of that year, she was at Scott Landry's house, and so was Mark Branch. Mark mentioned to her that he had a psychological profile that had been written about him, so this is where that hard copy comes in. Cheryl asked if she could take it home, which he agreed to, but told her not to share it with anyone else and to burn it after she was done reading it. So Cheryl agreed, and she cut his name out of the profile before bringing it home. So that was back in August of 1988. Okay, so fast forward to Saturday, October 22nd, right? This is a few months later, and just 2 days before Sharon Gregory is murdered, Sharon actually gets a phone call from Mark, and Mark is asking if Cheryl still had his profile because he changed his mind and he wanted it back. So Sharon asked Cheryl, and she as in Cheryl, said she did still have it, and it was on the floor of their bedroom. So Mark was like, cool, I want it back. I don't want it out there, whatever. So the weird thing is that the psychological profile was never returned to Mark by either Sharon or Cheryl, and it was never found after the murder. So like, what happened to this profile? We don't know. It was out there. He was pissed. He didn't want it out there. And it's interesting because, right, you have this happening 2 days before the murder, and, you know, just 2 days after Sharon is called by Mark, she's murdered. And that morning that he murdered Sharon, he had that appointment at the rehabilitation center, and we don't know what happened there. And he also made a phone call from Scott's house that morning, and we still don't know what that phone call was. So I don't know. There's like a couple of thoughts I have in my head. Like, maybe he called Sharon asking again if he could get the profile back. So maybe something happened, you know, at the rehabilitation center that made it click. Like, okay, I gave these girls, or this really Cheryl, I gave Cheryl my psych eval back in August, I need it back. So let me call them. And Sharon answers the phone and he explains like, hey, I need it back, whatever. And then 2 days later, like, he's back at Sharon's house when he finds out that she's home alone. So like, did he go there to get the profile from her? And if so, if he did go there and got like the evaluation, did she say like, hey, by the way, like, I wrote my psych 101 paper about you? And then who knows what transpired? Like, did he get really annoyed about that? I'm not sure, but regardless, like, Mark Branch did not want his psych information out there, which, you know, I don't think anybody would. That's very personal, private stuff, so I can't say I blame him, but I'm really curious to know, like, what was in that evaluation and, you know, what she wrote about him in this alleged profile. So who knows what transpired, but for whatever reason, he acted in absolutely horrific violence. And then people who knew Mark and Sharon started to come forward, like more and more. So jumping back to Cheryl Gregory, she shared a story with police that Mark had shared with her. She said that while in middle school, Mark had dressed up as Jason and he jumped out of the bushes with a knife and proceeded to chase a young girl around the schoolyard with it. And he didn't harm her or anything, but he was trying to scare her. He told Cheryl that he wanted to try this again, this time on Halloween of this year, 1988. So I'm sure this story is part of why Mark ended up attending a school for troubled kids. But the trouble doesn't end there for him. A friend of Mark named Derek would come forward, and he had some eerie details as well. Many of Mark's other friends also gave interviews, but we don't have their names. They refused to have their names published. They wanted to stay anonymous because they actually were afraid of Mark, who hadn't been found yet at the time, mind you. So Derek told police that Mark often felt ostracized and not good enough. While at Greenfield High School, Mark would call girls at his school and say sexually explicit things to them on the phone. And then he would keep files on these girls with this information. And he really wanted to keep this all together in case he wanted to use their words later against them, if necessary. So obviously, this is painting a picture of who Mark really was. And he really didn't seem like a great person, not somebody who was very nice. A female student who attended high school with Mark described him as an outcast. She stated that he didn't fit into any clique in the school, and she said that other people have heard him talking about a plan to kill someone since they were kids, since they were like children. So this was something he just went around saying willy-nilly. He apparently had been fantasizing about this for years. Another classmate would come forward from middle school and stated that Mark had actually threatened to kill her, and she only remembered him in passing and really didn't have a connection to him at all. Allegedly, Mark had sent her death threats in letters and put a scalpel through a photograph of her, which he then stuck to her locker. He also threatened to stab another female student, and he left to attend a school for troubled kids after a mutual agreement between school administrators and Mark's family. So you can see, like, this kid was problematic. Like, I don't know what was going on for him at school. I feel really bad for people who feel ostracized or outcasted from other, like, you know, students or peers. Like, it's not a good feeling. I feel like I've been there myself at one point, and it's really sad. It's very lonely. It's isolating. But I don't know what was going on with this kid. He was acting very aggressively and violently. Like, you can't just, like, pull knives on girls at school, and you can't just, like, I don't know, talk about your fantasies about killing people. And again, like, this just goes to show people knew what was going on with this kid, but nobody was interfering in the way that they should have been. There was another well-known rumor that went around about Mark Branch, and apparently classmates who grew up with him stated that he tortured and killed animals. So, you know, if this was well-known, again, these are just red flags galore. I mean, I don't know what more, like, I'm sure a lot of people are wondering, like, what more could you do for the kid? Like, he's in special services, he's, you know, in a school for troubled kids. Now, as an adult, he's going to a rehab center. I'm not sure. You know, I think that's the really confusing part, is like that gap where people fall through the cracks of our system. And that's why it's so important for us to look at these cases, because what can we do differently as a society? Like, how could we make things better so this doesn't happen? Besides all the information that came out about Mark and his troubles, friends would come forward stating that Sharon was a well-liked and responsible person. She loved art and theater. She was smart, sweet, and she enjoyed laughing with friends whenever she could. She was known for caring for all people, and she had many friends and was extremely close to her family. She was a loving free spirit, and she loved the group Duran Duran and adored the family cat named Snookums. So the following morning, on October 25th, a caller notified the police stating that they saw an abandoned car in the Buckland Woods that matched the description of Mark Branch's vehicle. So Buckland is known to be one of the thickest woods in Massachusetts. It's very dense. And police arrived to the location and verified that it was Mark's 1983 Chevrolet Chevette. This location was 13 miles away from Greenfield. When investigators located the car, they noted that there was blood on the front seat and front console. There was no sign or trace of Mark anywhere. After locating the car, a search warrant was obtained by police. The vehicle was towed to the Massachusetts State Police Barracks and examined by police officers and a chemist for evidence. And this is what they found. During the course of the search, the chemists identified blood in the vehicle in areas including the accelerator and brake pedals, steering wheel and automatic shift lever, the emergency brake lever, and the driver's side outside door handle and inside handle, the carpeting on the driver's side in the front, and the plastic console housing the shift. After this was tested, it was confirmed to be that of Shannon Gregory's blood. In the meantime, Mark Branch was still on the loose. The town was in fear. Many residents, including kids, would state that they couldn't sleep knowing that this maniac was out on the loose. Greenfield was a safe place. Now the residents locked their doors, which is something they didn't really routinely do before. They wanted their kids inside before dark, and they did not want their children playing outside alone. The town didn't know what else Mark could be capable of, so they just were anticipating the worst. With Halloween around the corner, many people wondered if he'd be back for more carnage, especially with the release of Halloween 4 and his obsession for horror films. Many couldn't help but wonder if he was going to pull a Michael Myers next. The town decided to cancel showings of Halloween 4 at the local movie theaters. So not only did Mark Branch ruin this family and, you know, murder this poor girl, but he also ruined like spooky season for the whole town, which, you know, I think a lot of people would be up in arms about that. He just overall sucks. The town also decided to cancel their annual Halloween parade that was set to take place the week before Halloween. Then, as the candy-filled holiday quickly approached, they decided to move Halloween and have it 2 days prior, with trick-or-treating hours occurring in the afternoon when there was still daylight. Residents were told to keep their porch lights off to deter trick-or-treaters from coming at night. So Halloween would come and go, and there was still no sign of Mark Branch. Parents prepared indoor activities for their kids on that day, and a local elementary school had a Halloween dance, and all was well, thankfully. There was no carnage that night. Even though it wasn't your normal trick-or-treating, you know, Halloween experience, at least, you know, the kids and the families of Greenfield got to do something. During this time, extra police patrolled the tree-lined neighborhoods. They cracked down hard and were not going to take any funny business. They notified the community that they would not stand for anyone who was going to go around doing Halloween pranks such as egging, TPing, and especially if anybody even thought of dressing up as Jason Voorhees, like, they were going to have a problem. The residents of the town cooperated. Like, everybody took this very seriously, as they should, so thankfully there was no problems there. And even the Greenfield Community College set up group counseling for whoever wanted to talk about the recent horrific events, you know, and the fear that had been swept upon this town. So whether you knew the Gregorys or whether you were just really scared that this guy was just going to pop up at any moment, like, there was group counseling, which was really nice. So, of course, as Halloween came and passed, police in the town were on their toes, anxiously awaiting for Mark's return. Like, everybody was like, when's he going to come back? Like, is this going to be just at the most unexpected time? His 19th birthday was approaching, and many feared that he'd come back for a birthday massacre. But he didn't. Police decided to contact a very well-known psychic medium from Long Island, New York, and his name was John Monty. Monty had actually been featured on TV before. He helped solve many cases over the years, and I don't know how you guys feel about, like, police psychics. I think some of them are super useful and, like, they blow my mind, and then there's some that just really shouldn't even get involved and, you know, they just give families false hope and it's pretty disgusting. So I don't know. I think there's a very fine line. But regardless, when police showed Monty a picture of Sharon, he stated that he felt nothing but violence. And he said, I keep getting the name Jason. Like, that name just keeps repeating in my head. And police didn't tell him any details of the suspect or of the murder. They kind of just, you know, told them that they were looking for somebody and they wanted to know, like, what came to his mind when he saw pictures of, like, these two individuals. So John actually claimed that he was seeing disturbing images in his mind, and he led police through the woods of Buckland, which, remember, very dense, thick woods, and he would end up leading them to an abandoned slaughterhouse deep in the woods, I'm sorry, and this looked like something straight out of the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. It was pretty scary looking. So police were, like, hesitant at first, but they decided to go inside, and they wondered if this was actually Mark's hiding place. On the wall, someone had spray-painted Jason Lives, and right up the stairs, they found another spray painting, but this depicted a drawing. It was a woman running up the stairs and what looked like Jason Voorhees chasing the woman with a knife. And underneath the picture, it said, "Deadly Intentions." So, of course, red flags everywhere. Police were wondering, like, seriously wondering, like, okay, was this Mark's hiding place? It had to have been. Like, come on, what are the odds? And it was extremely creepy because this picture depicted exactly how Sharon had been murdered. There was no evidence to prove that Mark had written or drew any of these, but they were pretty certain at this point. So, of course, at this point, Mark Branch is still nowhere to be found. So, John Monty said an image kept coming to him, and he was seeing a man hanging from a tree. And John was convinced that this person was Mark, and he was convinced that Mark had already killed himself, committed suicide, and he told police that they would find him hanging on a pine tree, that he was wearing blue jeans, black combat boots, and that the noose was made of his belt and shoelaces. So obviously, this was a very detailed vision that John Monty was having, but needless to say, regardless of the search efforts, they still couldn't find Mark. So there would actually be no word on Mark Branch's whereabouts for over a month. In late November, it was deer season, and a hunter was out stalking a deer in the Buckland Woods. He claimed that he heard a twig snap, and when he looked up, he saw a body hanging from a pine tree. The person hanging was dressed just like Jason from Friday the 13th. The hunter immediately phoned the police, and he was wondering if this was the missing Mark Branch. The body was hanging just a mile from where his car was found, and when police arrived, they realized that had they kept walking 200 more yards past that old abandoned slaughterhouse, they would have found Mark Branch. The coroner stated that the body had been hanging there probably since the day of Sharon Gregory's murder. So they believe that, you know, after he committed the murder, he went and took his life. So of course, forensics confirmed that it was Mark hanging from the pine tree. They confirmed it by using his fingerprints and from the wallet in his pocket that contained his photo ID. So of course, after this happened, there was a huge press conference and, you know, they went over the case and everything. But rumors began to swirl around town that Mark did not hang himself. It was believed that an angry mob hung Mark Branch in vengeance of the murder of Sharon Gregory. However, this seems to be more of an urban legend than anything else. You know, police came out and they discounted these rumors and said like that was completely not true, that he in fact did do that himself. But needless to say, after the murder of Sharon Gregory, the town of Greensfield was never the same. To this day, we don't know what type of mental illness Mark had. His parents fought very hard to keep his psychological reports and evaluations sealed from the public. It's difficult to find much information about this case other than what I already told you. It's almost as if someone didn't want the details getting out to the public. And I wish we knew more about Mark and his relationship with his parents and even, you know, the relationship between him and Sharon. Like, I want to know what happened. Like, was that psych assignment real? Like, how did this psychological profile even happen? What happened to the psych evaluation that he gave Cheryl? Like, there's just so many questions. And I would also like to know what happened at the rehab center that morning, because whatever happened that morning at his appointment seemed to really, like, get the wheels turning. And even within the days prior, you know, for him to give that report to Cheryl back in August and then all of a sudden become really fixated on it in October, I can't help but think something had to have happened. And you know, the more I thought about it and after researching this case, I couldn't help but wonder if Mark really meant to kill Cheryl, because she's the one who had the psych evaluation initially, and she was the one who wanted it in the first place. So I wonder if Mark went there looking to kill Cheryl and thought he was killing Cheryl, but instead killed Sharon, because they were identical twins. And perhaps, like, after he did what he did, he realized, like, oh my God, like, I killed the wrong person, which led him to, you know, taking his own life. I mean, police did come out and they also discounted this theory. There were other people who thought about it. And, you know, police really do believe that Sharon was the intended victim. I don't know. Like, after reading everything, it really seemed like Cheryl asking for the evaluation, like, threw a monkey wrench and everything. And the only thing we know for certain is that Mark did, in fact, give that psych evaluation to Cheryl. Like, we have Cheryl to confirm that. As for, like, Sharon writing some psychological profile on Mark Branch, like, we have no evidence of that. No paper was ever found. And, you know, if you think about it, like, why would she do that? Because Cheryl mentioned, like, you know, earlier in the story that Sharon was, like, afraid of Mark. Like, she was frightened just by the way he looked at her. So, I don't know. Would you really, like, want to go and write a report about somebody who scared the crap out of you and then tell him about it. Like, I don't know. Something just seems a little off. And I mean, it could just be the gap in details that we have. Because like I said, there's not a lot of information. And, you know, there's a lot of missing pieces with the information that is available online. It's like you could find like maybe two or three newspaper clippings that don't have much information. And then there's another few articles that I found, and one of the affidavits for the case. But other than that, like, it's very minimal. So again, we have more questions than we do answers. But regardless, this was a very scary case. So that is the very scary and very true story of Sharon Gregory and Mark Branch. Unfortunately, I realized after the fact that we do have a Friday the 13th this month, so maybe I should have waited to release this episode next week. Anywho, there's a lot to take away from this case. It made me think a lot, and it reminded me of the Aiden Fucci case. You know, if you're not familiar, I did do an episode about this case a few episodes back if you want to go check it out. But anyway, Aiden Fucci stabbed a cheerleader to death, and there were a lot of red flags, a lot of warning signs. He apparently was talking about wanting to kill somebody for a long time, and nobody was really interfering. And it almost sounds like that's exactly what happened here with the Mark Branch case. Like, he was actively talking about his fantasy of being Jason Voorhees and killing people. And the scary thing here is that Mark actually had mental health interventions. Like, he had gone to a school for troubled kids. He was getting mental health services. He was going to a rehab center, but he still committed this crime. Whereas with Aiden Fucci, he wasn't really getting any of that intervention. So I don't know what to think. I don't know what your thoughts are. Definitely head over to my socials and let me know. Feel free to DM me or comment about this case. I'm interested to hear what you guys have to say. Until next time, guys, happy October. And yeah, if you know someone who sounds like Mark Branch, or you're in a similar circumstance where you're kind of concerned about somebody's behavior or words, maybe think about saying something. There's a little, like, I know it's corny, but there's truth to, like, you know, if you see something, say something. It's the same thing. If you hear something, say something. You know, I think we could all help each other out a little bit more. But again, there were just multiple times people could have intervened or could have came together to try to figure out how they could help Mark Branch, but instead people really ostracized him, and, you know, he became a social outcast, which just led to things escalating and getting worse. So anyway, guys, the next few weeks are going to be Ghoultober themed episodes, so I'm excited to share those cases with you and spread awareness to some lesser known cases, and then also, you know, just analyzing more well-known cases. Hope to hear from you guys soon. Until then, stay safe, and yeah, see you later. Bye.